Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, as I mentioned on Tuesday's open Ask Me Anything episode for all Realignment listeners, regardless of their subscription status, this is basically a vacation week for The Realignment. We've been going at a heavy clip, and a break from the usual programming schedule has been much appreciated. That said, I mentioned a few months ago that I was bringing back my RE Something Interesting series, focused on just interesting topics, conversations, and authors that aren't usually directly related to the political system in the way a typical Realignment episode is, but instead speak to broader issues in our society. I'm pumped to restart that series with this special Thursday episode with this great book that I really enjoyed. It's called American Flannel: How a Band of Entrepreneurs Are Bringing the Art and Business of Making Clothes Back Home. My guest today is Stephen Kurtz. He is a reporter at the New York Times, and American Flannel is all about looking at this manufacturing and reshoring of America's industries through the lens of the clothing industry. Huge portions of America's economy, going back to the 1970s, were dominated by the manufacturing of clothing, yet that industry largely went overseas. So looking at the entrepreneurs who, since the 2000s, have been trying to do just that, bring that manufacturing process back home, has been incredibly enlightening, and I think speaks to bigger trends that the Realignment is focused on public policy issues. You can find this book at the RE Something Interesting bookshop, linked in the show notes, and hope you all enjoy this slightly different, a bit lighter than normal conversation. Huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the work of this podcast. Stephen Kurtz, welcome to The Realignment.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So this episode is a work, an author whose work resonates with the weekday policy themes, but are going to be a little fun and a little less homework focused. So I'll kind of kick this off in that spirit by just asking you a question I'm curious about. What are you wearing? Who are you wearing? You're writing about style at the New York Times. And as I was putting together my outfit for today, I was thinking like, oh, I'm going to possibly be judged by what I bring to the table here. So what are you doing?
I should expect that question. So I'm wearing a Woolrich sweater, which is one of the companies that's near and dear to me. And I talk about it in the book. I grew up like 25 miles from Woolrich, Pennsylvania. I'm wearing Todd Snyder jeans, and Todd Snyder makes some things in America, some things overseas. He tries to make what he can here. And I'm wearing an American Giant t-shirt and Zecano socks. Both those companies are in the book. And I try only to wear Zecano socks and support Gina, the woman who founded the company.
Are you someone who, when you're doing your shopping, you have a very good outfit if people are looking at this, if they're listening to the audio version of this, are you someone who, before you wrote this book, did you find yourself wearing a lot of these American-centric brands because they were cool, because they were hip, and then actually just the made in the USA part is a side benefit? Like, what was your relationship with the brands that you just referenced before you actually wrote this book?
I met Gina in 2016, so I've known about Zecano. So I've probably since 2016, 2017, I've been wearing Zecano socks. And like I said, I grew up near Woolrich, Pennsylvania. I've been wearing Woolrich since I was in high school. And, you know, it was in the early 90s. Grunge was big. I would go to the Salvation Army to look for vintage flannels. And because Woolrich was right there, you know, there was all this Woolrich clothing. So there are days where I'm sometimes head to toe Woolrich, especially in the wintertime, you know, from the socks to the cap. But, you know, I've gone through phases. In my 20s and 30s, I was into designer clothing and, you know, spent way too much money and wasted way too much money on Prada and Gucci and, you know, that sort of thing. I would say in the last 5 years or so, I've kind of nailed a style that I'll have the rest of my life, you know, for better or for worse. I probably won't change that much in certain colors and certain brands. And, you know, those brands are American Giant and Woolrich. And there's an Italian brand called Massimo Alba that I like a lot. But it's not all American made. I mean, and it's impossible really to do all American made. There's just some holes in your, you'd have holes in your wardrobe. You know, there's just some things that aren't made here. But I'm a lot more aware of it now, certainly after spending all this time reporting, and do my best to support.
And to be fair, from a full transparency perspective, I am wearing Madewell and J.Crew basics to help my suburban podcasting work feel pretty straightforward. I don't have to choose much. You know, speaking of how you've really seemed to have found your style in the past 5 years, something you point out at the start of the book, and that just got me thinking, you made reference to styles of clothing that are actually originated in the United States. So blue jeans, high tops, button down, dress shirts, Western boots, durable workwear, all of those categories, with the exception of the high top sneakers, you could date in some respect to the 19th century. And in many ways, if you're kind of thinking to yourself, I'm leaving my 20s and I kind of have found my thing, like what are clothes I could buy that are quality and I could just conceivably wear for the next few decades, you'd be in a great place by just sticking to those categories. What is uniquely American about those American origin categories, and what has given them the staying power that they have in your telling?
Well, they, you know, they all really grew out of workwear and their clothing for laborers. You know, I mean, Levi's jeans, you know, Levi Strauss started making denim, you know, dungarees for miners out west. And Filson's brand is a heritage brand from the Pacific Northwest. C.C. Filson, the founder, he noticed that people were passing through Washington to get up to Alaska during the gold rush in the 1890s. So he started outfitting them in clothing and other things they would need in a rugged environment. Carhartt, Hamilton Carhartt, very similar. He started making things for railroad workers. Woolrich started in 1830, and John Rich, who founded the company, would go around on a cart, on a mule, you know, pulled cart, and sell socks and fabric and things to men in lumber camps in central Pennsylvania. So you had clothing that really came out of this like laborer, worker, workwear tradition, and the clothing had to be durable. You know, it had to be durable because these were difficult jobs, and it wasn't luxury. You know, now you kind of pay for luxury. You know, you may have a flannel shirt that's like a $400 flannel shirt or something, but you know, this was clothing that was geared to workers, geared to a worker salary. So it had to be kind of modestly priced and really durable. And you find that a lot of the heritage, the American heritage, the American style, came out of that tradition. And I think that's why those garments are so enduring, and people, you know, still go back and try to find Levi's jeans from the 1940s or 50s because they're just made so well. You know, they're incredibly made.
So you're doing something really interesting in this book, which is that you're telling, at least my interpretation as a person who works in these spaces, you're looking at this discussion we're having in this country on reshoring our manufacturing and really focusing that big societal news narrative through the lens of the clothing industry. And a fact I just did not know before I read this book was that at the height of the domestic manufacturing industry, when it came to clothing, like 2.4 million people in the 1970s were employed making clothes here. And you're from the Northeast, so you could correct me. Like, I was born in Texas, so I grew up in Oregon, so I'm not from either space. But 2.4 million, that's around the same number of people who are employed in like the auto industry. And it seems as if our country doesn't have the same level of psychic wound from the decline of the manufacturing of from the textile clothing industry than we do in related spaces like the automobile industry or manufacturing in the Rust Belt. Would you agree with that interpretation, or would you disagree?
I totally agree with that. And I think it's a very astute point. I mean, yes. What one of the things that interested me about this is that this was a huge industry. I don't know the rankings, like but it was up there with autos. I mean, auto, you know, like I don't know if it was second or third to automobiles, but this was a massive industry in the mid 20th century and really going all the way back to the founding of the country. In terms of like the late 1700s, you know, the textile industry started. It was the first industry, first American industry. It started in New England and supported whole regions of the country. I mean, New England had textile mills and, you know, a lot of the footwear was made in New England. You know, in the 20th century, the Carolinas and the Southeast became the place where the sort of hub of textiles and apparel. And over a period of 40 years, from around 1980 to now, it almost entirely disappeared. So, yes, to your point, and it wasn't, yeah, I mean, I'm sure, you know, like if you read newspapers in the Carolinas and other places, like there was probably a lot of hand-wringing about it and people talking about it. But this entire way of life just disappeared, and there really was not a greater national conversation or, as you aptly put it, like a psychic wound around it. And then you saw, you know, I saw examples of like anytime Detroit would get into trouble, even if the presidential administration was committed free traders, you know, like the Reagan administration in the 80s kind of came in when the Japanese were taking a lot of market share from the big three automakers and, you know, put tariffs in place. And then during the financial crisis, you know, billions were spent to kind of prop up the auto industry and get them through that. That kind of attention was not paid to the apparel and textile industry. And there was a great heritage to it, but it was almost as if, you know, on Wall Street in Washington, people kind of looked the other way and just said, okay, like, you know, or maybe even in a way actively promoted its offshoring. And then, you know, I'm a newspaper reporter. I've lived through this experience of when you were in an industry that is kind of like disappearing around you. And so it occurred to me, after I had done these stories for the New York Times, it occurred to me that a lot of the people who lived through this upheaval were still alive. And I really wanted to talk to them about what that experience was like, to see what was a huge industry virtually disappear in your lifetime. And I was really curious about the people who had made it, you know, like who had survived this giant upheaval and how they survived.
Yeah. And I'd love to understand the distinction between those who left and those who stayed, because let me put it this way. Was it that the folks that stayed like made the affirmative choice to stay, or did for whatever reason their business model or their exact product just continue to make sense? So like what kind of distinguished someone who says to themselves, look, like we've been in New England for the past 80 years, but EOD, these collapsing prices have presented a huge opportunity for us, or we can't compete with our fellow customers. Like how do you tend to think of that?
Yeah, I mean, there are various stories and paths to survival. Some people some people were in a niche where they could just make it work. You know, there are companies that kind of like Alden Shoe, you know, it never had this growth focus. It wasn't about getting huge. And so they could just kind of plug away, whether their style of shoe was in or out, you know, whether, you know, whatever the winds of free trade or globalism were going on. Like they were just well managed and conservatively run. And so they could stay in business. You know, Rancourt Shoe, which is this company that I write about, they're one of the last makers of hand sewn shoes in America. I mean, the people they employ doing it, it's a lost craft, and they're, you know, they have to be like one of the last people in the country that does this. So Mike Rancourt.
And are those like hand sewn dress shoes? Like what type of shoes are
they? Yes, they're hand sewn dress shoes. And
so there's a whole other issue there too in terms of
style.
It's
such an art. I mean, it's very different. I sat for 45 minutes in that factory. I went a few different times and I just sat and watched at the hand sewer area and watched these men and women do this. All of them had been doing it for, you know, probably 30 years. And it was like a ballet, the way they did this. It's not easy. It's strenuous work. And if you make a mistake, you ruin the leather. So Mike Rancourt, the guy who runs the company with his son, and he got into the business because his father started it. Like in the early 80s, he made this decision not to go mass and not to go down market. What happened was the Reagan administration lifted tariffs for shoes to come in from Taiwan. There's this whole flood of cheap footwear. It put a bunch of people out of business. And Mike Rancourt realized, I can't compete in this mass way. There's no way I can compete with this. And so I'm going to go into the quality side of things and make really beautiful shoes. And they're going to be more, but I'll find a customer for that. It's like, don't compete on volume, compete on quality. I found that story over and over again. You know, I write about, you know, I write for the style section of the Times. So much of the fashion industry is about trend and marketing and putting on this like amazing runway show and what big actress or actor are you going to get to like promote your brand. The conversations that I had with the people that I write about, they were entirely about quality. That's their whole focus is quality. It's not about marketing. You know, it's not about like having a really great, you know, e-commerce portal or what can we do on social? I mean, I don't want to say all of them are oblivious to that. They're not. But so much of the focus is really on like, how can we make this shirt better? How can I spend time on the factory floor to make these socks beautiful and make this design really interesting? And that's how they compete. And that's how they've been able to stick around, at least on the apparel side. Like very briefly, on the textile side, it's so intensive that, and it takes so much cheap electricity to make textiles that, and this big machinery that the American textile business was able to stick around longer. It's harder to offshore that because of the capital that goes into setting up a textile plant.
And as you pointed out.
The book kind of talks about both a little bit.
Yeah, and the distinction is really interesting because as you pointed out, when it came to the actual manufacturing of the shoes, like literally in certain cases, you could just put the actual factory on a ship and send it to Asia in that case. So there's the difference between like the textile and the manufacturing side is really key. So here's something I'm curious about. So I'm really interested in how I'm 32, just had my birthday. So I'm at the age where I've been through enough like adult era trends that you could kind of see things start to demarcate differently. Yeah. So for example, you write about how a lot of these brands in the United States, so not only these already existing brands that had this revitalization periods like Red Wing, think of the boots there. Think of a lot of the brands that like Todd Snyder, when he was at J. Crew, really brought into the discourse starting in New York and then going elsewhere. A lot of these brands had this like long-term like heritage focus that became fashionable for a variety of like actual practical reasons and just like narrative reasons. That though is a trend in itself. Like when I have a pair of Red Wing boots, when I put them on, I do feel like I'm in my 30s, like very actively. Like let me put it this way. Like when I was 22, like 2014, and I'd be in New York and I'd see like this just like super cool dude, like decked out, like, he's got his expensive boots, he's got like the perfect outfit. I'd say to myself, like, yeah, man, like when you've made it, that's how you're gonna look. And like now that I like have quote unquote made it and look that way, I'm struck by the fact that no, you're now just aging. So do you worry that with this heritage wear trend, it's going to actually be not that there is this long-term sustainable viewpoint that these things like look good and are cool, and actually this was a trend that is going to age as poorly as some of the like hipster Williamsburg stuff that isn't quite the same thing but rhymes with it in the same respect?
Yeah, you know, I lived through that too, and it was funny for me. I write about this in the book, this experience of, you know, having grown up among deer hunters in the sticks of Pennsylvania who wore Woolridge, and then seeing guys, you know, with big beards and Woolridge buffalo plaid and Red Wing boots, and they're going to like a wine bar or something or an art gallery on the Lower East Side. It was strange, but then also I found it, I was heartened by it. And I thought, I was like, oh, a piece of my heritage, you know, a piece of my home is now trendy. You know, it was interesting, and I wasn't offended by it. But those brands are classic, and they've been around for over a century. you know, many of those brands that got big during the heritage movement, Carhartt and Filson and Red Wing and Pendleton and Woolrich. And yes, it was trendy. I think that period is over. I think peak heritage was probably maybe 2012 or something. And we're more than a decade removed from that. And we lived through it. And so there's a part of us that you put that buffalo plaid on and you think about that experience that you're talking about, you know. But okay, someone who's 15, who in 10 years they'll be 25, they have no memory of that. And yet the clothing will still be around. It's iconic. It's timeless. You don't feel foolish wearing it. And there are lots of things that are trendy. And I'll take a buffalo plaid coat over, you know, like some, I can't, like, you know, I'm failing to come up with an example, but you know what I mean, of something that's just like so trend victim. You know what I mean? Like, you know, where it's like, oh my God, that's so, you know, 2001 or that's so 90s or something. You know, so it was a trend, but it's also timeless. It's really your grandfather's clothing. And you can wear it the rest of your life. It's going to last, you know, probably most of your life because it's made well. I think those brands will still be around and they may cycle in and out of a trend, but they'll always be classic.
So what you just said about, you know, choosing the durable, certain classic thing over the trend, when you were talking about quality, I'd be curious what you think the word quality means in a world of fast fashion where none of us are working. Well, to be fair, if you listen to this podcast, you're probably, you know, on your way to your job in Austin, DC, New York, SF, LA, et cetera. You're not on the way to like really pushing your work boots to the limits in the Pacific Northwest or the Northeast. Right. So in that context, to what degree do people like, what does quality mean in a world where my H&M t-shirt from 2015 that only lasted a year, it was so cheap that I was on trend while I was wearing it. So like, who cares? Like how does the strike riding with the strike make you think about, because when everything is also very cheap, because it's not, because it seems like the real disaster zone would be, not only is this a low quality t-shirt from H&M, but it actually costs a bunch of money too. So there was a real like, you know, like choosing sides here, but it's like, it was $5. So who cares? Like, just tell me about quality in that context.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, there's a, I'm thinking of a few things here. One, who cares? Like there is a kind of consequence to that. And the consequence is, think about the corners that had to be cut to give you a $5 t-shirt. Or when I was reporting this book told me they had gone into Costco and found a pair of jeans for $4.99 or $4.50 or something. And they're, you know, boggled their mind because you know that that garment was made in abhorrent conditions, you know, and all kinds of corners were cut. And think about how much the workers who made those clothes were paid. I mean, you know, pennies. And then think about the landfill that when you're done with that t-shirt because it faded two times through the wash and you sort of throw it away. And now it's in a landfill. I mean, apparel is it, I mean, next to oil, I mean, it's probably one of the worst, you know, polluting industries out there. So, okay, then let's flip that. Let's talk about the coat that you're going to have for 20 years or the pair of jeans that you're going to have for, I don't know, at least several years. And you're minimizing your footprint. Like, it's money well spent. If you did any kind of prorating it of like, okay, this is what I spent on, you know, this pair of jeans, and this is how many times I wore it, and this is how long it lasted. There's a real value proposition there. And, you know, like, we all have to be conscious of what we spend. And so, you know, and then there are examples. I think Red Wing has a program like this. I know Rancourt does, where you can send those boots and those shoes back to the factory and they'll resole them. And so it gives that garment, those pair of boots, you know, a much greater life. I mean, this is how people used to shop and live 75 years ago, before consumption became the driver of the U.S. economy. Like, you go into a really old house and you look in the closets, and it's such a tiny closet. They probably had, you know, they didn't have a lot of clothes, and, you know, one or two good suits and a good coat. And I have tried to kind of pare down and live more that way, and just be more intentional about the choices I make. And so, like, to me, that's where the quality comes out. I think it's a range of things, like from environmental to financial, all kinds of benefits from buying something and buying it once, and it's going to last.
Yeah, really well said. It kind of gets to the, and I think this is why this is a fascinating industry, because the actual consumers themselves have, like, we all contain multitudes. So it's actually a variety of different ways that would kind of appeal. And it feels like the strongest brands that you're writing about are brands that are able to hit multiple vectors. So it's not purely, speaking of the 2000s, think of Tom's Shoes. Tom's Shoes, they hit like the environmental and like the poverty vector. Hey, like, we give one of these to like a starving child in Africa. I wouldn't say they hit the timeless part. They're not hitting the quality part. And that kind of is a good way of maybe thinking about different parts of success here. You know, here's something I'm really curious about. And I'll speak to your New York Times style reporter aspect of this. I know it's the style section. You're not just writing about style, to be really precise there. It feels like we're in a really interesting period in early 21st century male fashion, where especially, so I work in tech, we're kind of at a transition point where people are starting to care about things again. So like every other week, you're now seeing a Mark Zuckerberg outfit where it's not that he's wearing his slightly a little too tightly fitting black t-shirt that he has 50 copies of, like, right. It's 2011. He's wearing like super cool tiger print outfits to a wedding. And I saw there was a piece on Sergey Brin intervening at Google because their AI efforts are struggling. And he was wearing this insane coat. And the people could look this up on Twitter. It was really cool. It was this like really cool, really fashionable coat. And if you listen to people in the tech industry, especially when they were sort of at the height of power when it came to American culture in the early 2010s, they would say, look, we wear all birds because they're minimalist and they're straightforward. Think of Elizabeth Holmes. I wear the Steve Jobs turtleneck because I don't want to have to choose what I'm wearing, AKA it's a waste of time / kind of superficial. And if we're just sort of shifting to somewhere else, that's just something that I've picked up like recreationally walking these spaces. I'm curious like what you think about my kind of like thesis here in terms of what you're seeing in the world.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I should put a caveat that I don't follow trends the way I used to. And even though I'm a style reporter, I don't really cover clothing in that way. But as you're talking, what I'm thinking about is if you're around long enough, you just see the pendulum swing, you know? Mm-hmm. And I know I'm feeling myself. I'll give you a perfect personal example. I'm married. I have a couple kids under five. The pandemic, everything was about comfort and sort of like, how can I dress in a way that's really comfortable? And that meant not like wearing around jogging pants all the time, but it just meant like sweaters and sort of looser clothing and things that, you know, I can just sort of throw on in the morning because my mornings are really busy getting two boys, you know, ready to go to daycare. Lately, I have been kind of wanting to dress up again and put on a suit and put on dress shoes rather than, you know, New Balance sneakers, you know, like to kind of get out of like dad mode.
That's a very specific East Coast dad uniform.
Yeah, it's like, and I know,
I'm with it, but I'm not try hard. That's what that
right,
looks speaks
exactly.
To me.
And I know when I'm doing it, I'm like, man, I look like a dad here, you know. And lately, I've been saying like wanting to kind of dress up again. I just think I don't know what it is, but we're sort of have this internal thing personally, and then society has this internal thing where there's this constant pendulum that swings back and forth from, you know, casual to more formal to, you know, like really branded to I don't want to wear anything that has a logo. I mean, you know, for so many years that kind of like I'm going to wear a hoodie to the meeting because I'm the CEO, it was kind of a flex. And maybe that's just kind of going away. You know, people crave novelty and newness. And, you know, there are some people that, you can wear the same uniform for 20 years or whatever, and that's your thing. I mean, it'd be funny. I'd be curious to know if Steve Jobs was still alive. Like, would he still be wearing the black turtleneck? Probably not.
You know, because before that, he was double-breasted suit guy. Like in the '80s, he's wearing.
Right.
So like he, if you actually look at him, he's living both ends of that pendulum swing.
Yes. Right. Exactly. And you know, like we're all kind of creatures of our time. Not all of us, but you know, a lot of us are kind of creatures of our time. It's interesting that you've noticed, you know, a return to kind of like Prince and a little more flamboyance. And then, you know, I'd have to think about it, but there's probably things going on in the culture that are making people want to do that too. So, yeah.
You know, something I'm curious about as we're talking, some thoughts are coming to mind. So there's different categories of American-made clothing, obviously. And when you were talking about them hand-stitching shoes, my actual reaction to that was, hey, I'd love to, that just sounds great. Like, because once again, you're kind of, I've had a pair of dress shoes for the past 5 years. And that's just been great because before, like, you know, you're in college and you buy like a cheaper pair and it's out like every year. Just having one pair has been really great. But another reason why I've had dress shoes for the past 5 years is I don't wear dress shoes that much anymore. There's less of a danger. So how do you differentiate? I mean, actually, what was it just like to look at a hand-stitched dress shoe company where the issue isn't even just this is hard to do? The knowledge in the sector is literally dying out, but like actually the number, the sheer addressable market of people who are looking for something like that. But actually, no, but weirdly enough though, once again, I'm just talking out loud here. That's probably a stronger position to be in because actually of those people who are still buying shoes, are they people going to like an Aldo outlet at like your local mall? Like there's one of those like near the mall that I'm near in Austin versus no, I actually just love clothes. I love dressing up. I love in New York City. People know what I wear. I can kind of see it going either way in terms of you being in a difficult position at a company level.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when the pandemic hit, I felt for, you know, I'd done this is a slight tangent, but it's related. I'd done this story several years ago on this amazing department store in Philadelphia called Boyd's. And it's one of the last of its kind. You know, it's like the kind of department store that every medium and large size city had at one time. It's all clothing. They're really well known for their menswear. And you can buy a lot of really beautiful formal clothing there, and a lot of it comes from Italy. It's an old world experience. You walk in there, and it's like you're stepping back into time. And when the pandemic hit, I thought, oh my God, I feel for them because who's buying a suit, you know, and beautiful dress shoes when we're all wearing jogging pants and talking on Zoom and not going to the office? What are they going to do? And it turned out that Boyd's came through that experience stronger, and they opened up another store in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And like, I would say a couple things about that. Like, you're right, it can go either way, but okay, if you're one of the last people standing, even if it's a small segment of consumers that are still interested in beautiful dress shoes or still have a need for them, they're going to come to you. You know, and that's kind of the Rancor business model. That's why they went high end. And it was like, okay, well, I'm not trying to get everybody here, but I'm trying to get my loyal people. Also, a place like Boyd's, a department store, or a company like Rancor, they've been around a long time. And, you know, their customers are loyal because they know how well made things are. I bought a pair of shoes from Rancor and it was like Christmas Day. You know, like it came in this beautiful box and like really thoughtful, beautiful box. And you open it's all like wrapped in tissue and you open it up. And having been to the factory, I knew what had gone into making those shoes. You know, I probably had some abstract idea before I wrote this book, but I had actually stood there and watched them make hand sewn shoes. So when I opened that box up, I was like, oh, you know, and they weren't that expensive and I'll have them for a long time. So, you know, there's always going to be a kind of a clientele, I think. And the other thing about that is that, and I say this in the book, but I kind of describe them as these companies are like flowers in the desert. You know, they have evolved to live on very little water. You know, I mean, they just know how to survive. You know, you didn't survive this 40, 50 year upheaval where 98% of the apparel industry went offshore without being a survivor and knowing how to survive. So they're going to get through a pandemic and they're going to get through a down period where people aren't wearing formal clothes as much or wearing this or wearing that. You know, they're just going to figure out a way to kind of make it work. You know, the great majority of them. I'm not saying they're impervious to, you know, economic forces, but, you know, as was the case with Woolrich, but the majority of them really know how to survive.
You know, here's something I'm curious about. Did you watch the Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, Nike movie that came out last year?
No, I want to. I've been meaning to watch it.
Well, it's on Amazon Prime. So
I know. And I have Prime. And whenever I see it, I'm like, you know what? I really should be watching that movie, but I haven't got around to it. You know, I think it was Ben Affleck's costume or his hair. It was so off-puttingly 80s that I thought, it was like, do I want to spend an hour and a half in this visual world?
Do you know what I love? This is the tangent. I'll get to it, but this is actually, I love that you said that, because side note, I know exactly the image you're talking about, because like when you actually go to Amazon Prime, they show you like a still of the movie and they have a still of Ben Affleck dressed as Phil Knight. And you're right. It is actually ill. It's not just like off-putting. It's kind of alienating. And yes. I'm just realizing there is someone at Amazon who made a bad choice of still to capture the movie. Because it's funny, because Michael Jordan doesn't actually appear in the movie. Like they make that very specific. They don't have like an actor. You can only see his back. You can see like a tall, like early 20s, like black guy. Like all you could see. So they can't give you a still of Michael Jordan. And like part of the movie too is that Matt Damon is in his fat Matt Damon mode. So that's also not visually putting. So I was realizing there was an analytics person who was sort of like, what do we show here? And maybe Nike would have charged them if they put like a Michael Jordan shoe there. Okay, so here's off the tangent. That's just a note for whoever at Amazon Prime is listening. But no, here's the actual question. So I think your book, American Flannel, that movie, and then Shoe Dog, so Phil Knight's memoir, make a really interesting combination of reading and watching, because it actually shows like how different clothing is as the industry that we'd think. So like have you read Shoe Dog?
No.
Oh, but Shoe Dog is an amazing book because it has all of the aesthetics of like an airport book that would be kind of like off-putting. Like CEOs have a book every other week. It's an incredibly well done, very, very interesting book. And Phil Knight and his ghostwriter made the choice to just focus on the first years of Nike up to the IPO in the early 1980s. So the book is actually basically about the struggle to build a company that relies on manufacturing. So the drama is, okay, we're building these in Japan, but now we need to basically trick the Japanese into being okay with us switching our production to Taiwan. And then, okay, we're going to try to launch we're going to buy an old rundown factory in New England and try to run it for a few years because of like some of the tax related issues that go into like those 70s, 80s debates. So you'd find it like very, very compelling.
I will pick it up.
Yeah. Cause like what I'm getting at with this statement, less of a question, more of a statement, is just that Air, the movie we referenced, is about like the marketing and sales side. Your book is really about the companies themselves and how they're positioned. And then Shoe Dog is actually about the struggle of actually like making and manufacturing these shoes. What would you say listeners probably just don't understand about the clothing manufacturing industry? Because you probably just think, okay, you make clothes and then you sell them and you have a store or not. And I think just if you look at these three products I just described, including your book, it's just kind of mind-boggling how complicated this actually is.
Yeah.
And so I was just curious what your reaction to that is.
It is complicated. You know, the spine of the book is I follow this guy, Byard Winthrop, who runs a company called American Giant. And they make everything in America, you know, which is really hard. I mean, from the grown cotton to the zippers to the buttons, everything. I mean, it's like being, you know, the chef of a locavore restaurant in the desert. I mean, it's just like you're very limited as to what your ingredients. So he sets out to make a flannel shirt in America, which hadn't been done since the 90s. And he has to resurrect the entire supply chain. So through that process of following him do that, you know, I followed him for about a year. I really understood all the different steps that go into making a garment. The cotton has to be grown, then the cotton has to be ginned. And then, you know, then it goes to a yarn mill, you know, where it's turned into yarn. And then in his case, he was making an old fashioned yarn dyed flannel shirt. That means every individual yarn is dyed a color. And then you take all those yarns, thousands of them, and put them on a beam, like a warp beam, and you put them on a loom, and then you sort of, and you weave them together. And then after that, it has to be napped and brushed and pre-shrunk. There are just so many steps to making a simple flannel shirt. And it's similar for jeans. I mean, knits are easier. T-shirts are easier. They're more automated. But, you know, I think people probably don't realize the amount of work that goes into clothing, particularly because you could go to H&M and buy a $5 shirt or, you know, a $30 shirt or maybe an $89 suit or something. And you think, well, this is cheap and it's disposable. But to, you know, even that product went through all those steps. It's just that, that it went through those steps in the most cost-cutting way. And so, yeah, I was really struck by the amount of work it takes. And I was also struck by the way that clothing, this was particularly true of flannel, but it's true of blue jeans, it's true of shoes. It's this really interesting marriage of engineering and art. You know, it's, you know, there's an engineering aspect to running this machinery, to working a napping machine, to nap flannel, to raise the fibers of the fabric in this, in a perfect way that you get a soft feel, but not too soft, and you don't break the fabric. And yet there's this art quality to matching your colors and dyeing the clothing and laying out the plaid and picking, you know, designing something. I mean, Gina Locklear, the other character in the book, she runs this sock brand in Fort Payne, Alabama. The brand's called Zucano. It was her family's mill. She grew up in it. I watched her. She puts designs on socks. She loves making flowers. It's like, it's beautiful. It's almost like she's painting with thread on socks. She does a lot of floral patterns. She also does dogs because she loves dogs. So I watched her one day. She had like a Scotty dog or something, and the dog had a little collar on it. Okay, so the base of the sock is purple and the Scotty dog is black, and then the collar is a pop of color, and it, maybe it's peach or aqua or some, you know, something. And it was just three or four lines of yarn for this collar. I watched her iterate for like an hour with samples, getting the exact color combination of base sock, dog color, and collar color right. And it was like watching an artist, you know, and that's the kind of attention to detail that goes into clothing, even something as simple as a pair of socks. And I don't think people really have an appreciation. And how could you? I mean, I could probably say the same thing about refrigerators, you know what I mean? or cars or anything. Like, you know, you don't really have an understanding until you're in a factory and you're in a supply chain and you see what goes into making things.
Well, no, and you kind of conveyed this in the book, but it's just clear that on the scale of things that could just be automated in a straightforward way, the process you're describing when it comes to the flannel or the socks is just way different than building an actual refrigerator, even though obviously the refrigerator is incredibly complicated. So just two quick notes here. One, as you're describing that flannel process, and you also mentioned this in the book, I think the quick realization that any listener is going to have is that almost certainly the flannel, quote unquote, that they own is not actually flannel.
Like, right. If they paid $20 for it.
Or even
$50.
Isn't it that they take, like, can you describe, because they take normal, they just print it on effectively? Like, what's the difference between, yes, like, what you so, think is yeah, flannel?
So the way Bayard made a yarn-dyed flannel shirt, and that's like your grandfather's flannel shirt. You know, that's the heritage brand flannel shirt. And like I said, that means every strand of yarn was individually dyed, whether it's you know, buffalo plaid, so it's red and black, or whether it's 10 colors, you know, you had to dye all those colors. What a lot of brands do, and certainly fast fashion brands do, is they'll take a bolt of fabric and they'll just, in effect, stamp on a plaid pattern onto that bolt of fabric. And they're not individually dyeing the yarn. They're just avoiding that step altogether because it's costly and time consuming. And so, yeah, so, you know, I don't know the degree to which, you know, what percentage of the flannel on the market is that way. But I know that if you buy a very cheap flannel shirt and the colors are on seasoned or on trend or something, that's likely what you're buying. The plaid pattern's just been stamped onto it.
And other side note, speaking of socks, what is your personal opinion on the fun/colored socks dynamic? I've started switching out my 2010s fun socks were just normal black, brown, gray. I got married in September and I was my dance lessons at Arthur Murray, and like my pant leg slightly rode up a little bit. So my instructor, who's a love you, David, very cool, very Gen Z. He's like 23, and he like made a comment about my slightly chuggy colored socks. So I'm transitioning, not just because my dance instructor said so, but that just to me feels like a category that the colors and the prints and the vibrancy there were very 2010s versus a like the rest of our lives, just like socks are this bright, bright colored thing. Like, what's your thought on that?
Well, yeah, I mean that kind of like the pop, it's called the pop sock, I think is the term that flash of color. I don't, that's a trend too, you know, like the socks have trends. And socks have had trends over the course, you know, like whether it was the 1700s or whatever, like it was the length of the sock would go up and down, you know, stockings or full sock, you know. But the older I've gotten personally, I'm more comfortable wearing silly, whimsical socks. And I don't do it for attention. I mean, again, like I'm buying Zecano socks, and I know Gina, and I know that she's putting sort of whimsy and color and style and design into the socks. And I like wearing them, but I was much more conservative. First of all, like until I was probably 40, my mother bought me socks. You know, I put no thought into it at all. And every year at Christmas time, my mom would get me t-shirts and socks. And so whatever my mother was buying, which was like gray Hanes socks or, you know, brown or black socks, that's what I was wearing. So I've taken initiative in my own sock wearing as I've gotten older. Like, no, I'm old enough now at 47 to shop for my own socks.
So for these last few questions, there's this kind of like emerging genre where you wouldn't find this under the Amazon organization, but the genre is very clearly, there's been enough time that we could look back on the 2000s and 2010s. Like the recent book about J. Crew's Rise and Fall and Rise Again by Maggie Bullock is also in this category. So just reading these books makes you think a lot about these trends and these features and how much of those stores tied up in those. The other big fashion trend, aside from just the heritage brands that you're really writing about, was just the direct-to-consumer technical materials. Think of the famous Lululemon pants. To what degree do you think the work in those categories is going to be long-term versus, to what degree is that like a long-term, okay, let me put it this way. In the same way that you could say that America created the blue jeans, you could argue that America also invented like the technical pant as a like 21st century hybrid work, your commuting like feature. Do you think that the technical pant and the direct-to-consumer bonobo style thing is going to be enduring, not in its specifics, but in like the broad category and the way that the other things we talked about are?
Fashion itself will probably be trendy and will go through the cycles that fashion goes through. And there'll be a period where we look back at yoga pants and be like, oh my God, that was so whatever, 2010s or 2020s. It will define a time. It will define an era. So I think those things, you know, will probably come and go. the idea, the business model of direct-to-consumer, you know, it's hard to be a prognosticator. Like, you know, it's a dangerous game. You're often wrong. But I think that's here to stay. I know that it liberated a lot of these brands. I mean, there were a flood of them, to your point. I mean, like, there were so many DTC brands. And if you didn't have a good product and you didn't have a reason for being, you're not going to stick around. And some of them have already, you know, gone belly up. But a brand like American Giant, you know, Byard's company, because they were direct to consumer, that allowed him to make things in America, because he didn't have to worry about putting money into the retail footprint and all those leases. And he could take that money and pay an American wage. And he could take that money and he could put it into the quality of the product. Same thing with Rancor and Company. They do a lot of direct-to-consumer. Same thing with Gina and Zucano. So I'm heartened by that, like, that business model and what brands can do with it and how it has freed a lot of brands. And what that means for allowing them to come back to some American manufacturing. I've never worn yoga pants in my life. Like, to me, it is very trendy, you know, or that kind of technical gear. So I wouldn't surprise me if it dated the way that, like, neon, you know, from the 80s dates.
You know, it's funny, as you're articulating that, I'm also getting a blast in the past. American manufacturing retail, someone can and probably will write a whole book on American apparel because there's obviously a bunch of other, you could Speaking not have just had like a side chapter on that, but there's like American apparel, there's a bunch of complicated legal and interpersonal issues there.
Right.
That's a whole other book, but that's something that someone could look into. Okay. So let's kind of, let's close here with the, like, why does this all matter part? Cause I think something you did really interestingly. Sometimes when people write these books, they feel the need to, like, introduce stakes, like, in a very, like, ham-fisted way. So, but you write the story, you tell the story. And then in the last chapter or two, you're talking about COVID. And the way that this actually manifested itself during COVID wasn't just the deglobalization, our supply chains in China piece. There was actually America outsourced a capacity to manufacture things in a specific way. And this manifested itself through the lens of the inability to build, to construct masks when China was quite literally, like, hoarding masks and expropriating factories that built masks at a time when people really needed those. So America, because we actually, I don't want to say a lot, I don't like the use of the word, we allowed the industry to go away, because it's not as if, like, anyone in the 70s had a, let's have our policy to maintain our resiliency when it comes to workwear brands. It kind of suggests false choice, right? Because it suggests, like, if you know anything about policy, you'd know that isn't quite how it works. But just, like, talk about, like, the real way that there's a stake beyond just, it's an unfortunate reality that when you travel up and down the Northeast, you see old factories that aren't active anymore.
Right, right. The book, and Byard in particular, I mean, and also Gina, and, you know, like, her town, Fort Payne, Alabama, was the sock capital of the world until the early 2000s. There were over 100 mills there that made socks. The whole economy of the town, the town's identity was around sock making. And it meant that anybody who was 18 years old could go right into the mills and get a decent job and a job with healthcare and, you know, and support their family. Both of them, throughout the book, you are, you know, and Byard is a very vocal person and he's on a mission and he has a lot to say about U.S. manufacturing. And so, you know, there's this conversation around, what does it mean that we offshored our manufacturing? And I'm looking at it through the lens of apparel, but really that's just a proxy for so many industries. You could be talking about steel, you could be talking about electronics, you could be talking about all kinds of industries that we lost and that we offshored. So what does it mean that we did that? And what do we owe the communities and the workers that used to make things? And it was it a good trade-off that we sent all our manufacturing overseas and in return we got cheap flat screen TVs and DVD players and clothing, you know, at Walmart. Okay. And these are somewhat abstract ideas, you know, if you haven't lived through it. If you are from a community that was a manufacturing community, these are not abstract ideas at all. And I personally am from an industrial place. I'm from the Rust Belt. So, you know, I saw this play out, but still they're somewhat abstract ideas. And what COVID did, I mean, I sold the book and started reporting the book before COVID. But what the pandemic did was it made all those abstract ideas very tangible. And it gave a kind of weight to the story I was telling, because to your point, we were looking on TV and seeing doctors and nurses in hospitals in the richest country in the world wearing trash bags and home-sewn masks and bandanas, because we had lost the capacity to make PPE. We had made medical gear in the 1980s and 90s, but it had been sent overseas because it was cheaper to do that. And not only that, we lost the capacity to make ventilators, and China makes the majority of our medicine. And I think it was a real wake-up call for people, like, oh, these are the stakes. This is what it means. You could have someone like Byard Winthrop in 2018 pound on the table and say, it's a national security threat, you know, that we don't make things here. And people go, okay, whatever, you know, like, give me my iPhone, you know, give me my cheap jeans. When the pandemic happened and you saw real world stakes, and you saw that, like, there was a moment where I think it was the American Medical Association called on the Trump administration to do like a, you know, sort of a like a World War II style, you know, flood the zone, you know, Manhattan Project to make medical equipment. And it was impossible. There was no amount of money that you could throw at the problem that was going to overnight, or even within a reasonable period of time, have us bring the capacity back to make ventilators and masks and other things that we needed. So, yeah, I mean, it was just like, it just made real all of those issues, that question of like, what does it mean to be a nation that can no longer make vital, essential things? And we saw that. We saw what that meant when COVID happened.
Man, we'll close there. But that last statement you made is particularly well taken, because I think it's easy to reduce these things to like economic debates, like out of a microecon textbook, like, hey, like, I remember from microecon, America specializes in oranges, Mexico specializes in limes. And you kind of treat it like it's this interchangeable thing. But even if the efficiency changes, this isn't as simple as a textbook where you can just shift. You have the knowledge. And I just like you defining these as, if you read your book and you understand the nature of what it actually means to manufacture things in these complicated categories, you understand that these aren't money questions. These are time questions. These are all those different factors. I mean, like, one of the final interactions that Gina features in the book, like, there's a character who's just like retiring, who has all this knowledge, and he has to take like a year to train somebody. I think it's hard to really understand that there are 1,000 different versions of that outside just the clothing industry. That, once again, that's the challenge isn't like, hey, how do I get a $50,000 check for an annual salary in someone's pocket? It's actually much, much more difficult than that. So, Stephen, very well said, and thanks for joining me on the show.
I enjoyed this conversation. So thanks for having me.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.